Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, I'm with Dr. Peter Saunders, who's an expert medic and also on medical ethics, and I'm going to be speaking to him about bioethics today. So thank you very much for coming, and I wonder if you could tell us about what the major bioethical issues are today.
I think considering this one has to start with abortion, because that's been really the game changer in Western culture. And people don't appreciate that abortion, legalized abortion on a massive scale, is a relatively recent phenomenon. It only really started in the 20th century and kicked off towards the middle and end of the 20th century. But now we're in a situation where 80% of the world's countries have abortion legalized. We have, authorities would agree, about 43 million abortions per year worldwide, which is an astonishingly big number when you consider that the total number of deaths from all other causes is only 57 million. 43 million, almost one in every two human beings who die is an unborn child. So, and then we're seeing the effects of abortion demographically, particularly in Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, where birth rates as a result have been so low, where they were aborting up to one child for every live birth, that it's affected the whole age structure of the population. And we're getting many older people, fewer in the working age group. And then, of course, further afield in South Asia and East Asia, there's the issue of sex selection abortion, where girl babies have been preferentially aborted, which has led to a big imbalance of males and females in the population. And that's fed into the situation where we have 160 million missing girls and women in South and East Asia, and the way that fuels into other problems like pornography, human trafficking, and so on. So I think abortion is huge, and huge in Europe. Then there's beginning of life issues, and I think this all began towards the second part of the 20th century with IVF technology, and then associated technologies like GIFT, gamete and fallopian transfer, artificial insemination, ICSI, so the acronyms multiply, and leading on to embryo research, experimentation, prenatal diagnosis, picking up genetic abnormalities before birth and what one does with those, and then related issues like save your siblings, DNA editing, three-parent embryos, all of that stuff. Then there are bioethical issues around contraception. What kind of contraceptives should we use? How do they act? At what stage in the whole conception process do they act, after or before fertilization? And then we have, of course, the end-of-life issues, not just euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, but related issues like organ transplantation and questions around that, withdrawal of treatment, not for resuscitation decisions, advance directives, and so on. And that's just life issues. So there's a huge explosion of things happening.
And what do you see as the trends that are going on in Europe today?
Well, Europe's quite interesting because on the one hand, you have three countries in Europe, Belgium, the Netherlands, and Luxembourg, being the very first to legalize euthanasia and assisted suicide. You've got assisted suicide being legal in Switzerland. And yet, we're not seeing a progression. We're seeing a lot of pressure to change the law in Europe's other countries, but there seems to be a lot of resistance to it. And one example, in Britain last year, bills trying to legalize assisted suicide were defeated in both Scotland and in Westminster by very big majorities. So there's a battle going on, but the boundaries aren't moving quickly. And with abortion, most of Europe's countries have legalized it under a variety of different conditions. Some are very restrictive, like, for example, in Poland, Hungary, countries like Malta, particularly those with a strong Catholic influence. Others effectively have abortion on demand. When we're looking at embryo research, again, there is a lot of variation across the continent, and it seems to be Britain that's leading the way in terms of all these new technologies. whereas many other countries have profound objections to things like pre-implantation diagnosis, prenatal screening for genetic abnormalities, cloning, the use of embryo research, and so on. So it's a bit of a mixed picture in Europe, and I think that's a reflection of the different worldviews that we see in Europe and the battlefield that goes on between them.
And that's just at present. Do you see any things that are over the horizon or on the horizon, new issues we might have to deal with?
There are always new things. I think this year the big things have been, first of all, three parent embryos for trying to prevent a very rare group of diseases called mitochondrial diseases from being passed on from mother to child, and whether we should be using that technology that involves two women and one man to produce embryos that aren't affected. That's been a big issue. DNA editing is now on the horizon because we now have tools that can very specifically chop out a bit of the DNA genetic code or replace it. And there are questions about whether we should be using those and safety questions about it, or whether we're acting God. I think the whole transgender thing has really burst upon the scene. And again, that's been made possible through the availability of technology, hormone replacement, and gender reassignment surgery. And of course, the change in the worldview, the whole sort of postmodern view that we determine our own identity. And then there are other things like robotics, which we're just really wading in the shallows on, but it's going to become a huge issue in the future. So there are lots of new things happening.
So why is ethical decision-making so difficult nowadays? I mean, what's giving this extra complexity?
I think there are a variety of reasons for that. One reason is that we can do much more. Mm-hmm. So if you go back a century, you had someone with pneumonia, there weren't even antibiotics. So the doctor would sit on the side of the bed and think about the pathological changes and hold the patient by the hand, but you couldn't do much. Of course, now we have gene therapy, we have ventilators, we have nanotechnology. We can do so much more. And of course, the more technology you have, you've got to ask the question, well, should we use it and in what circumstances? I think the whole shift from doctor paternalism to patient autonomy has affected it. So it's not anymore doctor thinks best and says the treatment, but it's all about patient choice. And of course, patients are far better educated as well. We have not just the mass media, but of course the internet, where you can Google the rarest of diseases and bone up on it and know more than your medical practitioner. So people know what's available and they're asking for it. And then I think the move to team decision making makes decisions more difficult, because you may have people with very different perspectives who find it difficult to agree on a course of treatment. But I think maybe the most significant factor of all is that we no longer really have a moral consensus in Europe about what's right and what's wrong. There are a whole host of different worldviews competing. And so it's not surprising at all that when people are starting with a different anthropology, a different idea of man, or different idea of destiny or human purpose, what human beings are for, how you value human beings, what the limits to technology are, that you have a huge amount of disagreement between people from the same countries and cultures about what should be done.
So talk about some of the worldview changes that are feeding into these issues.
I think the big change in Europe has been the shift from Christian theism, mm-hmm. Around, of course, the Reformation, the whole Puritan movement, and the evangelical revival and the countries it touched, leading on to the kind of reforms we saw under people like Wilberforce and the Clapham sect. And we're moving away from Christian theism and toward the new atheism. So we know historically that was all fueled by the rise of the Enlightenment, the rise of secular humanism, and the idea that human beings are not specially made in the image of God for a relationship with him, looking forward to redemption and life after death and the judgment, but rather the idea that human beings are just essentially another species, that they're clever monkeys, that we're the product of matter, chance, and time in a godless universe, that death is the end, and that morality is pretty much what we decide it to be. It comes down to personal choice. So when you get more and more people embracing essentially an atheistic worldview and secular humanist or post-enlightenment values, it's not surprising that when they get into the corridors of power or the mountains of culture, if you like, and I'm talking about parliament, the courts, the arts, media, entertainment, universities, and schools and colleges and business and institutions like the health system, once people with atheist worldviews and secular humanist values get into these positions, then they will influence the trajectory of the culture. And I think that's what we're seeing, so that people think in these terms, they frame laws in these terms, they behave in these terms. And we've seen in medical ethics the same kind of transition. So as we've shifted from Christian theism through to atheism and secular humanism, we've seen the rise of secular bioethics. So thinkers like Peter Singer, who believe that the value of a human being is determined by its capacity for rationality or relationship or communication, and that human beings aren't valuable because they're made in the image of God. And of course, once you start believing that, then it has repercussions for the way that you think about human beings and treat human beings, because an elderly person with dementia or an unborn baby or a child with a severe congenital abnormality is not seen as a human being with rights in the same way. And so we've seen medical ethical codes actually being shaped as well. And I think we've been through probably 2,000 years of medicine when the two biggest influences on the way doctors and health professionals thought were, on the one hand, the Judeo-Christian ethic through the scriptures, and which of course has been profoundly influential in Western culture, but also the Hippocratic tradition, going back to the Greek doctor Hippocrates in 600 BC. And it's amazing when you put the Hippocratic Oath alongside Judeo-Christian ethics, how much overlap there is. Both Hippocrates and the Judeo-Christian tradition were against euthanasia and abortion, for example. But what we've seen in the second half of the 20th century and coming into the 21st century especially, is a rewriting of ethical codes so that they're now very much emphasizing the values of secular humanism rather than Hippocrates or the Judeo-Christian tradition.
And do you see much pushback on people like Peter Singer in terms of his view of many of people as non-persons and so on? I mean, is there much resistance to that, or do you think it's largely that the field is dominated by those sort of views?
Well, I think what happened in the second half of the 20th century, and this is perhaps a cynical view, but I think there were a lot of philosophers in university who could see that their own specialty was going to become time expired. Okay. And so people were going to universities not to study the arts and philosophy anymore. They were going to do accountancy and economics and business studies and medicine and law in order to get jobs. And so the cynical view is that the philosophers had to find something to move into, and they chose the field of bioethics. And so we saw this huge explosion of literature and people like Singer pioneering it. I think the thing about Singer and others like him is that, being philosophers, they're stunningly logical. And they start with a set of presuppositions and they work through to the logical conclusions of those presuppositions. And the logical conclusions are really quite horrifying. Because if you take Singer's view of personhood to its extreme, then like Singer, you'll end up backing euthanasia for people with dementia, infanticide for disabled babies, or children with special needs. And most people find that horrifying. But and so I think we're seeing a bit of a backlash to that kind of extreme, but I still believe that the majority of people in Europe are thinking perhaps inconsistently about medical ethics issues. In other words, they're not starting from a set of presuppositions and working it through to its natural conclusion, but they're going more with gut feeling or with what most people think, or they're standing up for the rights of those who they most closely identify with. So there's a huge amount of confusion, and in the churches as well.
And I suppose one of those things that Christians agree with Singer on, one of the points he makes very powerfully, is that the simple fact of birth doesn't make a difference, you know, before and after. I mean, for us, abortion and infanticide aren't very different, but the culture has made this big divide really at birth. So that's a sort of interesting feature there. And why do you think that is? Just because it's easier?
Well, I think Singer is absolutely consistent. Mm-hmm. So he'll say, what's the difference between killing a baby before birth and after? Mm-hmm. They're effectively the same age. Mm-hmm. And you can have a baby 24 weeks old on a ventilator in a neonatal unit that's outside the womb, and you can have one at 39 weeks that's inside the womb. So it seems a bit funny to be killing the older one and preserving the younger one. So he's saying, if you accept abortion, you've got to accept infanticide. Mm-hmm. And I think he's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. Of course, the other way around is to say, well, if we think infanticide is unacceptable, then why do we think abortion is acceptable?
So
I think it's these are good tools that you can use to make people think.
So how can we as Christians engage with these questions which are facing our society?
Well, I think we've got to go right back to first principles. Mm-hmm. And I think if we're honest as Christians, that a lot of us are really using pretty much the same methods that the world is using in terms of coming to our opinions on these things. So we're guided by gut feeling or by perhaps conscience, what makes us feel guilty or doesn't, or authorities, what people are saying, or what the consensus of opinion is, rather than really thinking back to first principles. And I think when I'm thinking about a Christian framework for medical ethics, I think there are four things that are really important. Mm-hmm. I think the first is that we really need to try to have the mind of Christ. And I think that means applying a Christian worldview and thinking in terms of creation, fall, redemption, future hope, and applying that whole grid to issues. So, for example, if we're thinking about gene therapy, for example, I personally don't look to the genetic revolution for long life and perfect health. I'm looking beyond that to, you know, to the resurrection. So I think having the mind of Christ and having a specifically Christian worldview based on the fundamental doctrines of evangelical Christianity is key. I think the second thing is holding to the commands of Christ. Mm-hmm. So at very root, the command of loving God with all our heart, soul, mind and strength, and our neighbor as ourselves, but also applying the principles that we see in Scripture, both in Old and New Testaments, like the sanctity of human life, like respect for the marriage bond, like using information about people to serve them rather than to oppose them, using it against them. The whole question of the end not justifying the means. So, so understanding the commands in Scripture and how they apply to contemporary situations. I think the third thing is having the character of Christ, because we may be able to think our way through to what is right in a given situation, but then it takes an extraordinary amount of patience, courage, fruit of the Spirit in order to be people who are making good decisions and carrying them through. And then finally, I think it's about carrying the cross of Christ. And I think that means being willing to suffer for making the right decisions, being willing to be part of the solution in difficult medical situations, like if we're going to say no euthanasia, then what are we going to do to help people who are suffering and in pain at the end of life? And I think the movement of Christians into the palliative care movement has been one expression of that, carrying the cross of Christ. I think in the same way, if you're not going to allow abortion, then you've got to provide support for good antenatal care, maybe adoption, helping people with disabled children and so on. But I think carrying the cross of Christ as well as being part of the solution also involves being prepared to speak out and being a voice for the voiceless often against great opposition, and being willing to face the opposition that that inevitably will bring. So, having the mind of Christ, holding the commands of Christ, developing the character of Christ, and being prepared to carry the cross of Christ, and starting from that Christian foundation to then apply those principles to individual issues. So I've got a great burden for getting people back to basics.
Now, in terms of the policy, do you think we can have a major influence on policy? How can Christians get involved in shaping policy?
I think we've got to be optimistic about it, because of the extraordinary power of God, the fact that God is sovereign and in control, and he can work miracles. So we shouldn't think of ourselves as a small marginalized minority who are trying to preserve Christendom in ever diminishing ghettos, but we should be seeking to be salt and light in society, and being the influence that we can. Now, I love Wilberforce's approach to this. You know, we all associate Wilberforce with the abolition of the slave trade, and of course that was one of his greatest achievements. But he talked too about his second aim being the reformation of morals, and he wasn't talking about it in any kind of legalistic sense. If you look at his analysis, he says there are four things that are important. The first is the peculiar doctrines, and he was talking about the fundamental doctrines of evangelical Christianity: justification by faith, the divinity of Christ, his death and resurrection, the coming judgment, and so on. He said, once you believe these peculiar doctrines and come to faith, they get hold of you, and then they lead on to the second thing, which is true affections, a passion to live a godly life and to glorify Christ. And then those true affections lead on to moral change in an individual, moral transformation. That's the third stage. And then the fourth stage, he says, is political reformation. So when people who believe these life-changing doctrines, whose hearts have been changed, who've been morally transformed, get into positions of influence in the corridors of power, whether it's parliament, the judiciary, the institutions, art, media, entertainment, you know, we're meant to be salt and light in all of these things, then it will begin to shape and change society. And I think then we've got to look at the drivers of our cultural trajectory and the societies in which we live. And I think that the big ones are media, and I mean not just media, but film, arts, entertainment as well, which drive opinions. I think the courts and the judgments they make, parliament, and the institutions like the universities, business, health, and so on, which are driving, and to be salt and light in all of those places. And that's where Christians need to be, and then they can really have start to have an influence. And I think we see that where there have been successes in stopping the slippery slope and the downward trajectory of Western civilization, it's been because Christians have got into those places. So we should not be pessimistic. We should be out there. And I think, you know, I'm a great believer that most of us live in democracies. And I think, of course, the scriptures tell us that God institutes authorities. And he institutes democratic societies, but it's we who vote them in. And he's going to hold them accountable. So on that day of judgment, all of us who live in democratic societies will have to answer for how we used our vote and how we used our influence to shape and change the society in which we live. So I think that part of our duty as citizens is to seek to work to get a change of view and thinking in society, seeing people converted, but also ultimately seeking justice and getting laws on the statute books that really do protect the vulnerable and advance kingdom values.
So obviously, if you're being a citizen, very involved in society, you need to work with all sorts of others who have different views. Are there parameters for that sort of working? I mean, should we be prepared to work with anyone we can find common cause with?
I think there are boundaries that we don't cross, so we should never get in a situation where we're compromising our Christian beliefs or saying or doing things that would be wrong for us as believers. So there are red lines that we could never cross. But in the same way, I think that in a democratic society, we should be collaborating and cooperating with people who share our objectives, perhaps even for different reasons, with specific public policy goals. So I think back in biblical history of people like Joseph, Nehemiah, Mordecai, Esther, Daniel and his friends, who were able to shape societies which were in many ways quite hostile to their faith and values by, on the one hand, engaging with them, but on the other hand, not becoming personally compromised. So they had red lines they didn't cross, mm-hmm. but they were prepared to work with other people. And Francis Schaeffer talked, I think he was the one who popularized, whether he coined the term, but he certainly popularized the whole idea of co-belligerence, which is working with people with whom you may have profound disagreement on some issues, but agreement on some others. So you're prepared to journey with them towards a common public policy objective for a certain distance. And they're very good examples of that. We, in seeking to oppose the legalization of euthanasia and assisted suicide, we set up a coalition 10 years ago called Care Not Killing, and we had 40 organizations involved. And some were evangelical Christian groups, there were Catholic groups, there were other pro-life groups, but there were also disability rights groups. Mm-hmm. And there were some professional groups as well. And all of us were united on the aim of making good care better available and stopping the legalization of euthanasia. But if we talked about other issues, well, we had to park those at the door. And so we found that whereas any one element of the coalition would have been marginalized, by all of us working together and using language that all of us could use, we were able to be successful. I think one of the funniest and perhaps most successful examples of co-belligerence was the case in Britain where the Peter Tatchell, who's a gay rights proponent, mm-hmm. very outspoken, would disagree with us on virtually everything, mm-hmm. but he worked with the Christian Institute, an evangelical Christian mm-hmm. public policy think tank, on free speech. Mm-hmm. And so they were trying to stop the shutdown on free speech, and there were mm-hmm. other people like Rowan Atkinson, the comedian, mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. joined in as well. And all these groups worked together. And there was an occasion when Peter Tatchell turned up outside Parliament dressed as a policeman with a horse, but the horse was a pantomime horse with two people from the Christian Institute in it. And Peter held a sign saying, "Please insult me," you see. Now, this was all based on an incident up in Oxford where a student had told a policeman that his horse was gay, and the student was arrested and put in the cells overnight. And, of course, Christian Institute and Peter Tatchell were both saying, why should people be imprisoned just for expressing an opinion, just because some people found it offensive? That's ridiculous. So they're saying, please insult me. So these two groups worked together, and they were successful in stopping that law. So I think we've got to be imaginative, be aware of the red lines, but be prepared to cooperate.
Well, to conclude, I just want to talk about your optimism. Obviously, you're very optimistic about the future. It's in God's hands, the health of the church and so on. But as you look into the next few years and as we look at public policy, do you see any areas where you think we might get some wins?
Well, I think there are areas where we're holding. Mm-hmm. And if you'd asked me in 1992, when we first got involved at Christian Medical Fellowship and the whole euthanasia debate, what was likely to happen, I would certainly not believe that we'd get to 2016 and could look back on 10 parliamentary victories stopping euthanasia. Mm-hmm. So that makes me optimistic. I think also that with other debates we've seen on abortion, we've seen the line being held. I think we're seeing the line being held in Europe on embryo research in a lot of different countries. So there are grounds for optimism, and we can see the results of Christians and others getting involved to fight these public policy battles. You do have successes. On the other hand, the general picture in Western Europe and in the First World, really, I think, is of gradual decline.
Yeah.
And that is because the culture is moving from a situation where Christian theism was dominant to one where secular humanism and atheism are dominant. So the whole idea, you know, autonomy.
Mm-hmm.
Autonomy says we want it. Technology says we can do it. Moral relativism says why not?
Mm-hmm.
And those tend to be the driving forces. So when I look forward, I say there's an end game here, mm-hmm. and it's not looking good for us.
Mm-hmm.
And that really what is needed in terms of the things that Wilberforce talked about, the personal transformation, the political reformation, it's got to be dependent on a sovereign work of God. Mm-hmm. And I think when we look back in Europe, we've seen in the past that there have been times of revival. We saw how the Reformation and the evangelical revival transformed Europe. We saw how the Great Awakening transformed the US and went through all its institutions and cultures. So we need to be preaching the gospel expectantly. And we need to be making disciples, and we need to be training them to think through all these issues and seeking to present them as mature in Christ. And we don't know what the future holds. We don't know if we'll end up as a small remnant. It's possible. We don't know if there'll be a revival and a new reformation. And that ultimately is in God's hands. But I think what we have to do is to be sure that we remain faithful to Him, living consistently, seeking to glorify Christ, and being eternally optimistic about the future. Because, of course, we know the long-term future is assured. Every knee will bow, every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, and the glory of the Lord will fill the whole earth. There'll be a new heaven and a new earth. And we look forward to that day, but we don't know what the immediate future holds, if this is the last generation or whether there's more to come. But we are called to be faithful in this generation. And I think that means being optimistic that God can bring change, that it's in His hands, and that we must not be obstacles to that change.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Dr. Peter Saunders, for all the wisdom you've shared with us and for all the effort you've given to this area. So thank you.